Welcome to Chapter 2. Chapter 2 is entitled A Legacy of Freedom. In the United States, we really do have a legacy of freedom. We have a legacy of freedom that started when the Bill of Rights was passed in the 1790s and continues all the way to today. We take it for granted in this country. Our freedoms are fairly unique. No other country in the world has a First Amendment and protects freedom of speech and press quite as robustly. In Canada, in England, sure, they protect freedom of expression, and some other countries do as well, but no country has quite the level of free speech jurisprudence that we have in this country. But still, it's not absolute. And it took a while to get to this place. Many earlier generations were very concerned about freedom of speech, particularly in wartime. So a number of the discussions we're going to have in this chapter are going to be around the times of war, when the government is most likely to be concerned about people speaking out. How absolute should the First Amendment be? That's a question all of you need to answer for yourselves. There are some scholars who say, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, that even something as radical as shooting the president should be protected as political speech. I don't think anybody seriously believes that, but if you are a real First Amendment absolutist, somebody who believed that Congress shall make no law really should mean no law, you might actually want to believe something like that. Now, most of us, of course, understand that freedom of expression has limits. You can, if you want, joke with the guy or the woman as you're going through the scanner at the airport, "Huh, yeah, I got a bomb in that bag." But you probably don't want to, because you'll pay a price for that. Okay, so even though you can say it, there will be some what we call subsequent punishment. We'll talk a little bit more about that accompanying that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about English censorship. English censorship was fairly common. There were licensing procedures that took place in England. The Church of England was very, very concerned about Puritans and other people who were dissenting in the religious settings, and so they had licensing systems. Imagine going to Kinko's and having to have the government have agreed to photocopy your resume. Okay? Government at the time was permitted, in fact it was mandated, that they could review and pre-censor materials. In other words, you couldn't necessarily get something printed unless the government said you could. Now, here in the United States, we think that's blasphemy. And, of course, under our current First Amendment law, it is. Okay? But as early as 1644, English people were speaking out against that. Okay? John Milton, and again, if you've had 425 or are having it now, you'll probably recognize a little bit of stuff in this chapter. There is some overlap. John Milton wrote a document called Areopagitica. It was an eloquent defense of freedom of expression. He had written a tract talking about divorce, and the government wouldn't permit him, they wouldn't give him the stamp to permit him to publish it. So instead he wrote Areopagitica, which is subtitled A Speech for the Liberty of Unlicensed Printing. He really wasn't very happy about the British government's decision not to let him print his divorce tract, so he decided to print the Areopagitica. The Areopagitica is really a ringing endorsement of the importance of permitting all discussion to happen in the marketplace of ideas. Put on my best Shakespeare voice. Though all the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field. We do injuriously by licensing and prohibiting to misdoubt her strength. Let her in falsehood grapple. Not a great concept, grapple. Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter. In English, Milton is basically saying, we need to permit everyone to speak. Even if there's falsity, if you don't let falsity to fight with truth, how are you ever going to know what's true? We call this concept today the marketplace of ideas. Now, the marketplace of ideas works a lot like a regular marketplace. You probably have been to a farmer's market or an open-air market. Now, personally, I never met a piece of asparagus I didn't like. Love asparagus. And I never met a Brussels sprout I could stomach. Right? But I wouldn't have known those if I hadn't had a chance to sample. And that's the concept behind the marketplace of ideas. Ideas are set out like food in a marketplace, and we pick and choose. If we reject something, it's rejected, but we couldn't have rejected it unless we knew. Okay? And so Milton's concept and theorists after him have argued that all ideas need to be given airtime. In other words, we need to permit all these ideas to come into the marketplace, be discussed, be debated, you know, be punched out, if that's the outcome. We need to be sure to provide those places with a forum. And if we don't, then we're not really permitting truth to win. Okay? So it's a fairly well-known concept, and I'm sure you've heard it in other formats before. In this case, it was introduced by Milton and reinforced by later theorists we'll talk about in a few minutes. Okay, let's talk about John Locke. John Locke was critical to Jefferson and other drafters' ideas of how the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution should be written. Our American democracy is basically a social contract. We are governed because we agree to be governed. Now, you might think, well, you know, I didn't agree to be governed. Well, you know, we do have the right to vote people in and out of office. Okay? Social contract theory says that there is a duty of the government to provide protection for natural rights. When we're born, said Locke, we're happy, we're reasonable, we're tolerant people. Society can train that out of us, but our original state of nature is basically to be happy and tolerant. Okay? And government needs to protect that. We do give up some liberty to live in this society. For example, I can't go speeding down Commonwealth Avenue at 200 miles an hour, even if a car would do it. Okay? Because there are laws that say I can't. Okay? So I give up that right in exchange for other liberties, like protection of my safety and other people's safety. And Locke said, well, when the government stops providing that, we have the right to throw them out of government. Okay? We can rebel, which is, of course, what we did in 1776, but we can rebel against administrations if we perceive that they are not doing a good job. It just happened when we, you know, changed governments back in 2008, 2009. Okay? Natural rights, John Locke would have said, are right to life, liberty, property, and freedom of expression. So First Amendment freedoms are included in John Locke's notion of a social contract, of rights the government needs to protect. Okay. All right, sedition. Sedition is a really important concept. Sedition is criticism of the government. Say that again. Sedition or seditious libel is criticism of the government. And it's a very common thing during war times. People get worried, they get nervous when a state goes to war. Okay, it was very common in England to deter criticism of the government. In fact, the common law said, for it is very necessary for all governments that the people should have a good opinion of it, and nothing can be worse to any government than to endeavor to procure animosities as to the management of it. This has always been looked upon as a crime, and no government can be safe without it be punished. In other words, English common law was saying, you're fools if you don't punish this. Because frankly, if you don't punish dissent, people are going to keep dissenting and you're going to have a less stable society. Now, here in the United States, we didn't go that route. Okay? But back in England, even if the criticism was true, it could still be punished. Be it never so true, yet if slander is to the king or the government, it is a libel and to be punished. Okay? So we're going to go a different direction in the United States. We're going to go to the direction of truth as a defense. And the case in which it happened is the Zenger case. Okay, let's go back to 1735. John Peter Zenger was very similar to Akinkos. Okay, he was a printer. Now, he was also, he believed in a lot of the stuff he was printing, but he was printing a lot of stuff that was against the New York Royal Governor, a guy named William Cosby. He called Cosby a drunk and a womanizer and a gambler and he had syphilis and all this stuff. And most of the stuff, frankly, was true. The guy was a drunk and a womanizer and ate too much and all that stuff. But because Zenger had dared to print this and criticize the government, bam, he goes to jail. But he did a smart thing. He got a good attorney. His attorney's name is Andrew Hamilton. Andrew Hamilton goes before the jury and he says, look, my client published a whole lot of stuff. We're not even debating that. We know that he was critical of the government. But frankly, if you believe what Zenger wrote about the governor, you should let him go. All right. So he says to the jury, I hope it is not our bare printing and publishing a paper that will make it a libel. You will have something more to do before you make my client a libeler. For the words themselves must be libelous, that is, false, scandalous, and seditious, or else we are not guilty. So he says to the jury, if you believe what Zenger printed was true, you have the duty to ignore this bad law and let the guy go free. And what happens? Bang, Zenger goes free. Hamilton's plea worked. The jury said, yeah, we kind of buy the fact that, you know, this royal governor is, you know, sort of not a very moral guy, and we're going to let Zenger go free. Okay? Today we'd call that jury nullification, the idea that you encourage a jury to ignore the law. Okay? But back then, of course, we had the idea now that's been established that words had to be false to be libelous. That's still generally the rule today. When we get to Chapter 4, we'll talk about one case that has put a chink in that armor. But generally speaking, we acknowledge in this country truth as a defense. Okay. What does the First Amendment mean? That's a really loaded question. Millions and millions of words have been written about what the First Amendment means. I read many, many legal blogs, many of which try to talk about what are different elements of the First Amendment. Now, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, you know, abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. But we know that Congress does make laws abridging the freedom of speech and press. What this course is really all about is which laws are okay and which are not okay. We acknowledge, for example, that child pornography is not okay. Even though it's expressive activity, we as a society have believed that it doesn't really have enough value to protect. Threats, for example, are not okay. Okay? We acknowledge that threats do not have sufficient social value to protect. So this class is all about trying to figure out what laws are going to be okay, because Congress does pass a lot of laws. Okay? And there are billions of theories out there on what kinds of laws should be passed about freedom of expression. Now, I have some ideas about that. I'm sure you do. I'm never going to test you on what I believe. I'm going to test you on what the law is. Some of the law I agree with, some of it I don't. But it is more important to me that you know what the law is and can form your own opinions than that you agree with me. All right. Let's start out with some of the early laws that abridged freedom of speech and press. That fine-looking gentleman there is John Adams, Federalist President of the United States, number 2, second president, followed in George Washington's very large footsteps. The Alien and Sedition Acts were very unpopular. They were passed under Adams because Adams wanted to shut people up because he wanted to declare war on France. Okay? The actual law said you could be fined up to $2,000 in 1798 money. You could buy, like, towns for that. That's a lot of money. Or 2 years in jail for writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government in the U.S. So in other words, Adams was saying, whatever you think about our war efforts or whatever you think about the United States, zip it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want it printed. I don't want it published. Under his administration, there were 15 people indicted after 25 arrests, and all of them were opponents of President Adams and the Federalists. Okay, only one person was actually deported. People hated these. They were very unpopular, and some people would say they're the biggest black mark on John Adams' presidency. Now, John Adams didn't have a really great presidency anyway. This was one of the big black marks. Do we still have them? Well, actually, we don't, because that austere Virginian there is Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was very politically astute. He kind of took the pulse of the nation and found out people hate these laws. So when he ran for office against Adams, one of his planks in his platform was to get rid of them. Okay? So we no longer have them. And once Jefferson got to office, he pretty much said, I'm going to pardon everybody and pay all the fines back with interest. You know, go figure that happening now. The acts expired. All right? But there was still sedition. People will always complain about their political opponents. Okay? And again, when we get to wartime again, remember this is a wartime situation, we're going to see these sorts of things come back. All right. Now, a couple of scholarly views that are discussed in your book that I'd like you to know. Again, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of ideas out there on how the First Amendment should be run. But I've chosen three to talk about. Professor Overbeck has chosen three, and I've kept them. Leonard Levy is one of the first scholars to really formulate an idea on how the founders thought about freedom of expression. And he argued that there should be open debate on all topics of public interest. He was actually a marketplace of ideas kind of guy. And initially, he had thought back in the 60s when he first started writing about this that that was not true. And then in the 1980s, he reversed his opinion on it. Zechariah Chafee, another important First Amendment theorist, said, well, you know, I understand that we should be able to speak freely, but there's a point at which we have to not protect expression. And it is that point where the expression is actually imperiling the nation, or incitement. And we're going to talk about incitement a little later on in this chapter. Incitement is an important concept, the encouragement of unlawfulness. And Chafee said, look, when we're trying to encourage people to harm the nation, that's when the government needs to step in and say no. And finally, Alexander Michael John, another very famous First Amendment theorist, said, you know, we really need to have a solid connection between an unlawful act and a speech act. In other words, we can't just assume that somebody says jump and somebody else does it, that they did it because somebody told them to. In other words, we have to actually prove that the saying of the words resulted in the action. And if we can't do that, we should protect the speech. We have to make that connection. And again, there are many, many other theorists out there talking about how we should interpret the First Amendment. It wouldn't be a bad idea for you to know these three.